Senator Ferguson, all the distinguished guests on this platform, and ladies and gentlemen in the audience, I want to first express my appreciation to Senator Ferguson for a very generous introduction, and to you for coming out in such great numbers on a rainy night to give me the opportunity to get acquainted with you and to speak with you about some of the issues of this campaign. But before I begin to talk about the issues, I want to say something about Lansing and about Michigan State. This is the first time I have ever spoken in Lansing. As you recall, I did not get here during the presidential campaign of 1952. But like many Americans from my own state of California who come east to get their cars, it isn't the first time I've been in Lansing. In 1938, I got a 1939 Oldsmobile here and drove it to California. In 1941, Mrs. Nixon and I came to Lansing and got a 41 Oldsmobile, drove it to California. And then we liked them so well that in 1950, we bought another one that we still have. And incidentally, I know that somebody else will remind me of this if I don't say it. Since that car is 4 years old, I probably ought to be buying another Oldsmobile, so we'll probably be back someday and get another one before too long. I also want to say something about Lansing, what it means to Michigan, what it means to the country. It, of course, is the capital of your state, and also it means something to all the country in that it is the seat of Michigan State College. I had a great privilege in 1953 in Washington, just shortly after I became vice president, of giving the presenting the Coach of the Year award to Biggie Munn, the coach of Michigan State College. And then, you know what he did? I made a nice speech about him at that meeting in Washington with all the coaches present. I'm sure he must have got a salary raise as a result of some of the things I said. And then you know what he did? He was so ungracious as next January to go out and beat the Pacific Coast Conference at the Rose Bowl again when I wanted to win. All that I can say is that we can be thankful for small favors, and that is that Michigan State can't go this year. Maybe we can win if they don't come. I want to say one other thing about Michigan State that is very personal, but which is something I feel very deeply about a man who is with me here today. There's a small organization in Washington which does a great job for the country, the Secret Service. I think there are only about 250 agents in the whole Secret Service. I am privileged to have some of those men assigned to me from time to time. A man who traveled around the world with Mrs. Nixon and me and who was with me today on this trip is a graduate of Michigan State College 1948, Rex Scouten. He's a fine American, and Michigan State can be proud of him. I certainly am. And now, let me get immediately into the reason that I'm here, in case none of you have guessed it. I am here, may I say right at the outset, not to tell you how to vote, because if I did, those of you who were thinking otherwise wouldn't pay any attention anyway. But I am here to tell you what I think the issues are and to lay before you as honestly and as forthrightly as I can the case for our side, for President Eisenhower, for a Republican House, for a Republican Senate, and for a Republican in the State House in Lansing here in Michigan. Now, let me say this. I think you should listen to me, those of you who are here in this audience, and those of you who may be listening on the television or on the radio. I think also you should listen to the speakers of the other side. Weigh the issues, because America is great and becomes greater in its government only as the people study the issues and make the best decision on election day. And incidentally, I understand that there seemed to be some kind of objection raised as to whether or not the facilities of this great university should be used to televise the speech that I make. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not afraid to have the people see and hear us, and I'm not afraid to have the people see and hear our opponents as well. That's in the best American tradition. Now, I've already indicated to you that I feel that President Eisenhower and his Congress, the Republican Congress, has a great record, that it deserves support on that record. Now, I will have to admit that there's some people that don't agree with me on that. And one of them, a very able man, a leader of his party, Mr. Stevenson, made a speech on Saturday night in Indianapolis in which he disagreed very sharply with the appraisal that I have just given. And so I have chosen this particular forum to answer that speech. And I'm going to answer it point by point, and I'm going to let you be the judge. And I have written down here the statements that Mr. Stevenson made, the charges that they made from the transcript that appeared in the New York Times, which I had available to me yesterday. And I'd like to read the charge and then give you the answer in each instance. You judge from the facts. First of all, I want to point out that there were some things with which I agreed with Mr. Stevenson that all Americans could. And point one was this. I agree with him when he says, let us discuss our honest differences honestly. So let us do it. First, he charges that the Republicans sow distrust, mistrust, and hate in America. Now let's look at it. I wonder what he has to say about the tactics that he and members of his wing of the Democratic Party are using in attempting to set class against class, employee against employer, farmer against city dweller. And I can say that we as Republicans and as Americans are proud of the fact that as President Eisenhower has said over and over again, our program is designed to aid the best interests of all 160 million Americans rather than any special group. Because we believe that what is good for all is good for the special groups as well. And we think the American people want that kind of a program. And if Mr. Stevenson is referring to the distrust and hate, which I admit Americans have for the communists, for the fellow travelers, and the security risks that this administration has removed from government service, my answer is that the great majority of Americans, Democrats and Republicans alike, approve of the Eisenhower policy in that respect. And we're going to continue it, you can be sure of that. And then his second point is this. He claims or complains that he doesn't like, and I quote, catchwords or slogans. And then he adds, quote, the Eisenhower administration in the past 20 months batted 828 without scoring a run. A pretty cute phrase, but he apparently forgets that when this administration took over in January 1953, we inherited a war in Korea. Today, 20 months later, for the first time in 12 years, the world in which we live is at peace. And I say that's a great achievement of this administration. And in that connection, may I say, Mr. Stevenson may consider this achievement of our administration an error or just a hit. But to thousands of Americans who had loved ones in Korea, it was a grand slam home run, and I'm sure you will agree. And now, in that connection, might I just suggest this? I noted recently a speech that was made in New Jersey by a senator from one of our western states, Washington, Mr. Jackson. And in that speech, he criticized the Eisenhower foreign policy very vigorously, said it was inconsistent and weak and vacillating. And then later on in the speech, he said he could see no difference between the Eisenhower-Dulles policy and the Truman-Acheson policy. Well, in any event, he may not be able to see any difference, but I tell you the American people can. The difference is a very simple one, but a very important one. And the difference is this. The Truman-Acheson policy got America into war, and the Eisenhower-Dulles policy got us out of war. And that's something we can be proud of. Speaking of runs, I wonder what Mr. Stevenson would call the enactment of the St. Lawrence Seaway Project after Democratic administrations had failed for 20 years to put it over. I wonder what his opinion is of the monumental progress which has been made in removing discrimination in employment, in which this administration, without fanfare and demagoguery and double talk, has acted where its predecessors talked and talked and talked. And I can say this because I have worked in this field as chairman of the committee for the president. I can say that this administration has done more in 20 months for the cause of civil rights than the previous administration did in 20 years. And we're proud of that record, and the American people can be proud of it too. These actions may not be runs by his standards, but believe me, I think they are by the standards of the majority of the American people. Criticism number three, he criticizes the settlement into China, what has happened to the European Defense Community, EDC. It's very significant that on these questions, incidentally, that is, in the case of every other issue that he discusses, he offers no constructive policy or program of his own. And may I just suggest this? I think that he owes it to the American people, as the official spokesman of the ADA wing of the Democratic Party, to tell us honestly whether he believes the war in Korea shouldn't have been stopped, whether he believes that we should have sent boys to Indochina to fight, what he would have done on EDC or what he would do now on that or the other problems on which he criticizes the Eisenhower administration. He charges that at Geneva and elsewhere, we have succeeded in convincing our friends that we are rigid and inflexible and unwilling or unable to negotiate or compromise, and that the United States stands in the way of a peaceful world. Consider that for a moment. This charge, I declare tonight, is not only far from the truth, but it gives aid and comfort to our enemies abroad who are trying to paint the United States as an aggressor. And I am sure that even Mr. Stevenson will agree, and if he doesn't, that the American people will, that President Eisenhower and Secretary of State Dulles have made it clear over and over again to the whole world that the United States stands for and wants peace, and that all we ask from the men in the Kremlin and Peking are deeds rather than words to prove their good faith. And we think we should have deeds rather than words in view of the history of dealing with the communists over the years with which we have dealt with them. And might I just suggest that if Mr. Stevenson favors compromise or negotiation with the communists, as he seems to, he should tell the American people frankly what he would compromise, how he would negotiate. For example, does he believe that we should recognize communist China and that we should cease opposing its admission to the United Nations? Because he knows, as every political observer knows, that that was what the communists wanted at Geneva and what Secretary of State Dulles, to his credit, I say, refused to give them. And so let me make it clear that this administration at this point will continue to oppose with all the moral and legal force at its command the admission to the United States of a government which is pursuing the policies of an international gangster, the government of communist China. And we think the American people are behind that policy. I want to make it clear that we in this administration and in the United States want peace, but we believe that surrender is too high a price to pay for peace. We advocate a firm and a strong policy because we know that a policy of weakness in dealing with communist aggressors inevitably leads to war, and Korea is a tragic example of that principle. We should not underestimate, may I say at this point, the grave threat to peace which will continue to exist as long as communist aggressors are on the loose in the world. And might I suggest that in dealing with such men, it is easy to blunder into war. It is easy to get peace by surrendering to them. But what is hard to accomplish is the great objective of this administration, and I believe of the American people, of getting peace without surrender. We can reach this objective only if we are strong militarily, firm diplomatically, and cool in emergencies. And I believe that in President Eisenhower and in Secretary of State Dulles, we have men who, by experience, judgment, and temperament, are best qualified to give us this kind of leadership and to get the kind of peace that we in the whole free world desires. And I believe that the American people have confidence in that leadership and that they don't want to give it up and to return to the leadership of the Truman Acheson administration, which got us into the troubles that we had previously. He charges that the cutback in military expenditures was unwise, that it was weakened the United States. And at this point, let us look at the facts. Cuts have been made in military spending. They've been made in our spending abroad. But by spending more wisely, America today is stronger militarily than it has ever been before, and we are capable of meeting aggression whenever and wherever it occurs. And let us just remember one thing on that particular charge. Who is the man making the final decisions on what America's military strength ought to be? President Eisenhower, one of the great military leaders of our history. I just happen to be confident that the American people can have greater faith in President Eisenhower's judgment on military matters than that of Mr. Stevenson, and I think you will agree. And then he complains again now that the loyalty of Mr. Truman and his party has been impugned. May I set the record straight on this issue right now? No party in America has a monopoly on patriotism, and all of us should understand it, and all of us should believe it and talk it. The issue has never been and is not now the loyalty of Democrats versus the loyalty of Republicans. The issue is the inexcusable actions of a few leaders of the previous administration who underestimated the danger of communist infiltration at home, who ignored the warnings of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, who covered up rather than cleaned up when disloyalty was brought to their attention, and in doing so, they rendered, I say, a terrible disservice to their country and discredit to their party. And for that, they must assume responsibility before the American people. Some of you might well ask the question, well, what's the difference? What is this administration doing that's any different from what the previous administration did in this field? Well, I can tell you what it's doing. First of all, we have an administration in Washington which recognizes the danger of communism in the United States. We recognize it for a very simple reason. We just happen to believe that when thousands of American boys have fought and died fighting communists overseas, the least we can do is to deal effectively here in the United States with them, and that's what we're going to do in the future. Not only are we going to do it in the future, we're doing it now, we've done it in the past. What have we done in this field? One, we've enforced the existing laws vigorously as they were not enforced before. And two, we have gone to the Congress for new legislation. New legislation for which the senior senator from the state of Michigan was as responsible as any man in the United States Senate, and Michigan can be proud of his leadership in getting that legislation through the Senate and the Congress of the United States. What kind of laws, you ask? Well, I haven't the time to describe them all, but one you may recall. If you listen to the President's State of the Union message last year, you remember that he asked for a bill which would take away the citizenship of anyone who was convicted of advocating the overthrow of the government of the United States by force and violence. That bill has become law, and I think most Americans will agree that it should become law, because I happen to think, and I'm sure you will agree with me, that a man who chooses to be a communist doesn't deserve to be a citizen of the United States, and he should lose his citizenship if he engages in conspiracy against his own government. Fourth, we've been kicking the communists, the fellow travelers, and the security risks out of the government in Washington, not by the hundreds, but by the thousands, and we're going to continue to do so until we get them all out. And what is more than that, we don't hire them in the first place if we can possibly find out about them. And that's a great difference from the previous administration, too. And then, most important, this administration is cooperating with J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI 100%. That is why our program is successful. That's why you can have confidence that we will deal with this issue effectively and sanely. May I just say in concluding this portion of my remarks that this should not be a partisan issue. I know that Democrats as well as Republicans are loyal Americans and they want this issue handled and handled as we're handling it. And I say that Democrats and Republicans all over America should and will join together in supporting President Eisenhower's program of dealing fairly and sanely and effectively with the communist conspiracy in the United States of America. Let's take the next complaint. And this one is a very simple one. It's a sentence that reads, quote, "Still the deficit increases." Well, he should tell the American people what cuts in spending he would advocate that we haven't made. Because on the contrary, he's been advocating increasing the spending rather than cutting it. And I would suggest also that he might tell our people what tax increases he would advocate in order to balance the budget. And he should remind himself of the fact that had this administration not come to power in January 1953, the deficit would be $12 billion bigger today than it is because of the cuts this administration made in the old Truman budget. And if this administration had continued the recommendations of the Truman budget over the 4 years that this administration is going to be in Washington, you know what would have happened? We would have added $40 billion to the national debt. That's the kind of a program that he and his administration, the one he defends, has advocated. Compare it with ours. He says, "As to Republican slogans, I have nothing printable to say." Well, in this connection, I might say that he at least shows more discretion in his language than the man who handpicked him as the candidate of his party. He complains we have the highest cost of living in history under this administration, but he ignores the fact that for the first time in 15 years, inflation has been checked without controls, and that the dollars Americans earn today are retaining their value and will be worth a dollar 5 years and 10 years from now if the policies of this administration are continued. He expresses his dislike of, quote, "defamation, deceit, and double talk," end quote. Well, I think the American people are entitled to know, if he doesn't like that kind of thing, whether he approved of the sordid attempt of his hand-picked national chairman, Mr. Mitchell, to impugn the personal integrity and honesty of President Eisenhower and Bobby Jones. He complains that this is a giveaway government. Well, he's correct if he refers to the fact that this administration has given back to the people $7.5 billion in taxes that the other administration would have had to take from them if their spending policies had been continued. And parenthetically, might I add, that under the policies of this administration, we are taking steps to tighten up the lax procedures of previous administrations, which permitted espionage agents to give away to our potential enemies secret information from our State Department and our atomic programs. We're certainly not for that kind of giveaway, and we are certainly doing everything to see that it doesn't happen while we are in power in Washington, D.C. And then he quips that Republicans are renting, not buying in Washington. Well, I would imagine there's probably some truth in that charge, because he and all of the American people can be sure of one fact, that under the policies of honesty in this administration, a government clerk like Merle Young wouldn't be able to buy a $100,000 home and get a $9,000 mink coat free for his wife because she worked in the White House. And so if we rent, it's because we're honest. And you can be sure on this particular issue that in place of the old scandal of the administration, where we had corruption defended and covered up, that we have an administration today, and this is the most complimentary thing I can say about it, that from top to bottom reflects the standards of personal honesty and integrity of the President of the United States, Dwight Eisenhower. And I challenge anyone to show an instance of unpunished corruption in this administration, because the President has given orders to deal with it wherever it rears its head. Well, finally, Mr. Stevenson believes the campaign should be conducted on the issues. And, of course, I agree. You agree. I also believe he has a right and a responsibility to criticize this administration when he disagrees with it. But he also has a responsibility to let the American people know what his party would do if it came to power. Up to this time, we've had nothing from him but quips and criticisms without one positive, constructive suggestion as to what his party would do. And under the circumstances, we can only assume, as his national chairman admitted in answer to a question recently, that all a Democrat Congress offers, if elected this year, is a return to the policies of the Truman administration. Until Mr. Stevenson tells the American people how he differs from those policies, we shall have to continue to remind the people what those policies were. I hope that in his next speech, and it's going to be in Detroit on Saturday, that he tells the people how his policies and those of a Democrat Congress would differ from the policies of the Truman administration, so that we can debate the issues of this campaign on policies of the present rather than on policies of the past. Well, there is the Stevenson speech. There are the answers. Now, might I just conclude with this word to this audience. From what I have said, you can say that I believe we have a great record, a record which has the best chance to bring peace and to keep the peace without surrender, a record that has cleaned up the mess of loyalty, of disloyalty, and dishonesty in Washington. In addition to that, a record which I believe in the long run will provide the greatest prosperity and progress for all Americans in our time and in the time to come. And that record and our president needs support. He needs it in the House, he needs it in the Senate, and for that reason I urge, if you believe as I do, to support Senator Ferguson, to support your congressional candidate, and fix up the job and finish it well by having a Republican in the State House in Michigan as well. It'll be good for America. It'll be good for you. Thank you very much.